Thank you. Well, good morning. Thank you for making the trek down to 187A. I know you're really here because you intended to be here, because nobody trips over this by accident. I'm delighted to be here. How many of you have cases that intersect with the legal system that you know of? Raise your hands, please. Okay, good. Well, when we were talking, we thought among us last night that about 40 to 50% of those of these cases that you're working with are cases that people like me are working with. And so I'm kind of the outsider here. I'm actually here today because of a couple of people, Judge Bill Gladstone and Dr. Joy Osofsky. Judge Bill Gladstone from Florida, anyone from Florida, you would know this name if you were. When I had the honor of serving on the Board of Trustees and as co-chair of the Permanency Planning for Children Division of the National, this is a long one, you think you all have long names, National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. Judge Gladstone, who is probably 15 years my senior, kept saying, Connie, we got to think about the babies. We got to think about the babies. And I had had babies, and I knew they were important. I had taught in elementary school. I knew the importance of children and how we build their safety and security and self-awareness and all of that. But I really didn't have any idea how important it really was to our work, especially the infants and, as I call them, wobblers and toddlers. And so he kept pushing this agenda on the Permanency Planning Committee, and my co-chair, a judge from Omaha, I know we have another Nebraskan here, at least one, Doug Johnson, and I said, boy, he's right. And Doug Johnson had been a teacher, too, in his past life. So he said, we've got to really think about these babies. This was the mid-90s, late 90s. We didn't know a whole lot. You know, we were still relying on autopsies to see brain scans. And nobody wanted to see an autopsied brain scan of a baby, but it happened. So much was developing in the science that by the year 2002, Judge Johnson and I happened to be attending the annual conference for the National Council, and Joy Osofsky was one of the co-presenters. And we went in there, you know, thinking, well, hey, we kind of got this. You know, we might learn something. But we went out of there with our jaws on the floor, because we had never seen the still face. Does everyone know what I'm talking about? Okay. Changed my life, changed Doug's life. Said, we need to bring this to our states. And we did. We got Joy and others to come and show how judges and scientists can work together to bring that science to justice. And I've kind of rethought my little catchphrase, bringing science to justice, because it's more than justice. Because justice, we think of, you know, blind justice. Everything's the same for everybody. We treat everyone equally. But that's not what we do in child welfare cases. Because what we have to do is meet the people where they are. And when you are working with nonverbal children that are too young to speak in English or whatever their language is, you have to know how to read their cues, and you have to study those relationships, and you've got to see them. You've got to know so much. So, in addition to having been a teacher and a lawyer and a judge, I was also a pig farmer. And I know that's kind of stereotypical, you know, from Iowa, but hey, there were great mortgage lifters, and it worked. So while I was teaching, I was also raising hogs. And my grandfather was a rabbi. I have to put that in there, but we're reformed. So I'm going to ask, I'm guessing, are there any pig farmers in the, or farmers in the crowd? Okay. So okay, that's close enough, but you can play. All right. I have a little pig pop quiz for you. What's the gestational period for pigs? Does anyone know? Brought my little friend. Okay. Nobody knows that. It's 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days. Right. What is the safest way to pick up a baby pig? Pardon? Ask me to do it. That's a great answer. Pardon?
Are there valleys?
By their bellies? Okay, and that's what most people would say, because we're kind people, and we want to be supportive, and we want to get as much contact in as we can to secure the pig. But pigs don't like to be picked up, and they're going to squirm, and they're not slippery, but they're hard to hold on to. They're very strong and very wiggly, and so this is the safest way, actually, to pick up a baby pig. Now, you don't want to be doing that, you know, for 20 minutes. That's not good for the pig. But if you have to pick them up and move them somewhere quickly, this is the way to do it, because then you've got a good grip on their leg. They're not likely to wiggle out of your hands and fall and break something. And then when you're ready to set them down, you can support their little bellies and put them down. And they have trouble squealing when they're upside down, so they're not likely to wiggle and squeal. And it's even kind of calming for them compared to holding on to them like this, like those greased pig races that you see on the movie sometimes. So you're probably wondering, how much do I need to know about pigs from this woman? But I tell you this story because I want you to think about going into the pig business. I didn't know this when we started raising pigs, but we had a couple bachelor farmers next door that were so thrilled to teach us and help us get started in this business, even provide us with our first gilt, which is, anybody know what a gilt is? It's a female pig that hasn't had any babies yet. So the ones that have had babies are called, you probably know, sows, right? So we go into this business. We're both, you know, he's a lawyer, I'm a teacher. We've got day jobs, but we want to do a little extra. And so we start this pig operation. And we had a lot of help. We had mentoring. We had people who were experts in the field. And we relied on them because it would be ridiculous for any of us to think about dedicating our time and our family's resources to getting into a business about which we knew nothing. It wouldn't be very smart to dedicate all of that. So we had to teach ourselves. And you know what? Judges are in the same position. Because until about 10 years ago, I couldn't have even gotten continuing legal education credit for a session like this. It wasn't considered legal enough. It wasn't considered professional enough. Yet I was called upon day in and day out to make decisions about mental health, substance abuse, child development, relationships, what psychological services would best help this family. And it's ridiculous to think that I could do that alone without learning a heck of a lot more that I didn't have time to learn, because I got all these families that are relying on me right now. And every 7 minutes in our country, a child under the age of 3 is removed from their parents to foster care or relative care. That's a lot of infants and toddlers. And they don't usually tell you what they need by language. And so we have to learn how to do that serve and return, not only with the babies and the children, the young children, but the parents. Because our parents didn't come to us without a plethora of problems. They have experienced so much trauma in their own lives. Let me give you an example. We are very fortunate in Iowa to have one of the first and best, I think, parent partner programs. Parent partners are individuals who have survived the child welfare system. They've lost custody of their children. They've gotten their children back. They have maintained sobriety because, you know, nationwide, 80% of our children in the system are drug affected. They've had exposure to illegal drugs or prescription drugs. And probably in Iowa, it's 95% because of we're the meth capital. But all of these children come into the system, born to parents who have been abused, neglected, exposed to drugs. And in talking to these parent partners, who then, once they have healed, become sort of like AA sponsors to parents who are new to the system. And they're available 24/7, just like an AA sponsor. And I can't say, I know how you feel with your child having just been removed. That's why you're deer in the headlights. But these parent partners can. And the parent partners have been there. And they can tell you what to spend your time on and what not to spend your time on and what battles to fight and what battles not to select. And they can say, don't wear that marijuana t-shirt to the courtroom. They can say, don't cheat your drug screen. I know you're cheating your drug screens. And they're not going to tell me that. But you bet they're going to teach us in general, the latest and greatest ways to cheat your drug screen. So we learned so much from them, and one of the things they've so generously shared with us is that everyone who's shared her story, every female who's shared her story, was sexually abused by a caretaker when she was under the age of 10 and never told anybody and never, of course, got any help till right now. And so they have these deep wounds that they need to heal, and they don't have much time to do that because in Iowa, as in many states, we're talking 6 months from start to finish in a case. And there's a lot of tension because we know it takes longer than that for a recovery, for healing. We can give longer time if people are off to the right start. But we also have to balance the needs of the babies. 6 months to me is not much. 6 months to a one-year-old, half of his life. And so there is that tension because children need to know where they're going to grow up. They form their primary relationships of trust out of predictable relationships and environments. And so we're in a big race here, and judges need to have information and need to be motivated to provide the very best they can early on because the front loading is critically important. In Iowa, and it's a practice that's spreading across the country, have been able to change policy because things that we have tried in our demonstration courts through our 0-3 work and our model courts. One is the pre-removal conference. Used to be we would start out a removal, often with police in a drug raid, guns drawn, even if there weren't a drug raid situation. It was knock, knock, you got the police, the social worker, and we're here to take your child. And the baby would often become the tug of war in a battle. Because the parent, think how you would feel. You don't have any notice. All of a sudden they're coming to take your child. And maybe you would have been working with community cares and services, but there's no notice. It's surprise, ambush, we're here. And the child is, you know, talk about do no harm. We were exacerbating the harm to this child. And in the early days, we weren't even making an effort to place with family members whom the child may know. And so we got to doing a little research. It's always interesting to step back away from the anecdotes and the crunch of the day-to-day survival because I had a revolving door kind of docket, you know, please wait in the hall for a copy of the orders because we have another group waiting to come in. And so we decided, well, step back a minute and take a look at this. And we noticed that almost all the emergency removals were happening on Mondays and Fridays. Gee, it was funny that there wasn't any abuse or neglect in our community on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But, you know, Monday, the schools are calling, there's a bruise, there's, you know, we need you to check this out. Or Friday, what do you think? Well, we've been working with this family. I just don't feel very right about no eyes and ears on this child over the weekend. They're not going to daycare. And the daycare reporter's been saying this and that, and we think that mom's using meth. And so we backed it up a little bit and decided to do things a little differently and have a county attorney at the Department of Human Services every day to really analyze, is it an emergency? Is there imminent danger? Which is the standard that we have to apply. And then we took it another step and we thought, well, you know, most of these families we've been working with, especially the young children's parents, and they know they're not doing very well. There's a lot of support. So let's try a different approach. Let's bring the family with the parent partner and anyone the family wants to bring to the Department of Human Services, and in a family conference, a family team meeting kind of model, we're going to say, you know, this isn't working. What can we do to support you? And in the meantime, your child's probably going to have to live somewhere else, or the child will have to live somewhere else. And so the aunt is there to take care of the child. And we are getting the blankie and the passy and the things that the child clings to for security and comfort. And we've got mom not being yelled at, saying, you're a bad mom, you don't know anything, get out of here, and traumatizing her more and distancing her more. And instead of saying that to her, we're asking her, what are her favorite foods? Is there a favorite book? Is there something you can tell the caretaker that she might not already know? so that the transition is easier for your child, and we will be doing less harm, finally, in reality. And this new approach has been so successful that people who have unfortunately been there, done that before, have said to the family team meeting moderator, facilitator, this is so much better than the last time when you just grabbed my kid out of the crib. You know, are you going to get in trouble for being so nice to me? They actually have said, does the Department of Human Services know you're doing this? That's how foreign an experience it was to them. So by becoming trauma-informed, we need to talk to each other. We need to speak the same language. Toward that end, working as a consultant for the Quality Improvement Center Court Teams project with 0 to 3, we're working on some products, updating questions every judge and lawyer should ask about infants and toddlers' mental health and well-being that Joy co-authored in 2002. And we are putting together a glossary so that we can all be sure we're talking the same language. We're doing some fun things. One of the things that I developed that I never pass up an opportunity to talk about is my 2 for 2 book project. So it's real simple. Okay, Grandpa, you're taking care of the child, all right? And there's our child, there's the blanket. Your mom. So they each have the same book. And Mom, you're going to agree with Grandpa to call at the same time every night to read this book to your baby over the speakerphone. And Grandpa, you're going to hold the baby and turn the pages while he hears Mama's voice. And we're going to take it up a step. You're going to sleep with this blanket and rub your scent all over it, because we know babies have strong olfactory memory, bringing a little bit of that science to justice. So what are you going to do with the blanket while she's reading? Baby's going to smell you. And baby was a little traumatized by some of the things you were doing in your domestic violent relationship. But he's going to start associating your calm voice with the safe, secure arms of Grandpa, and that relationship is going to heal faster. So we can impact policy by knowing the science and applying it, but judges have to be taught. So be kind, dumb it down for us, let the lawyers know, because we all want the same outcome. The caption isn't the state versus the parent, it's in the best interest of the child. So thank you for your kind attention. Be glad to answer questions.